From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. By this point, we all know there's some unconscious part of our brain at work. But if you were to guess, just how much of our mental world do you figure is unconscious and how much is conscious? It's a tough question for a conscious person to answer, of course. Shankar Vedantam says we like to think most of our mental activity is conscious thought, but is it? Vedantam is the social science correspondent for NPR. He hosts the popular podcast Hidden Brain, and he explores this rapidly developing science that's uncovering this vast world of unconscious thought, those hidden forces and biases that influence our decisions. And Vedantam says the science is moving so fast, the question is no longer why do we have a hidden brain, it's why do we have a conscious one? Shankar Vedantam is joining us today. We hope you will too, after the news.
Hey, Radio West listener. We thought you'd want to know that the book we're talking about on today's podcast just happens to be available on Audible. Go to RadioWest.org and you'll find a link included with the show, along with links to IndieBound and Amazon, and any purchases you make through these affiliate partners help support Radio West. Thanks so much.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Shankar Vedantam says we all like to think of ourselves as rational creatures. We're conscious, so it's hard to imagine anything else, and we imagine ourselves as making very deliberate decisions about the things we do every day. But over the years, scientists have been uncovering this vast unconscious world. Vedantam compares it to an archaeological dig where researchers are scraping beneath layers of conscious thought, uncovering, as he puts it, an entire pyramid of unconscious brain activity. Vedantam has written a book about this science. He covers the subject for NPR. He has a very popular podcast called Hidden Brain. And in his work, he says it's difficult for us to become aware of the hidden forces influencing our lives. But if we put reason ahead of instinct, there may be a way to confront and deal with the fact that often our actions are at odds with our intentions. Shankar Vedantam is in town, and we have the opportunity to talk with him. He's NPR social science correspondent, host of the podcast I mentioned, Hidden Brain. Before joining NPR, he was a reporter and columnist at The Washington Post. His book is The Hidden Brain, How Our Unconscious Minds Elect Presidents, Control Markets, Wage Wars, and Save Our Lives. Shankar Vedantam, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Doug.
Well, you've mentioned before, and you mentioned this in your book, that you've always been attracted to research that explores complex social behavior. What is it? Like, go way back. What was it that interested you about it, if you think about it back then?
I think what fascinates me about this body of work is that it reveals a part of my mind that feels at such odds with how I think about myself. Mm-hmm. I think about myself as being a very deliberate, very rational, very intentional person. So if you ask me about who I'm voting for, and I'll tell you who I'm voting for, and I'll tell you why, and I know all the reasons, and I've done my research. And what fascinates me about this body of work that I've been exploring the last 10 or 15 years is it suggests that my view of my own mind is deeply flawed, yeah. That I have an illusion of, you know, autonomy and rationality and intentionality. But these are just illusions, that at a significant level, much of what happens in my mind is hidden from me, and that's what I call the hidden brain.
You know, it's interesting, and we'll come back to these stories, but there are a number of times in the book that you've written where you've talked, where researchers talk about discovering these particular things. Race is one thing that comes up. And the researchers themselves don't want to believe that they themselves carry these kinds of prejudices and biases. They don't. And I'm wondering if that's been part of the thing that you've been thinking about, is we just don't like to think about these sort of ugly things, ugly propensities that we may have embedded in us.
Absolutely. One of the things that fascinated me about this work was some of its applications in the study of prejudice. You know, the conventional model of prejudice is that people who are prejudiced have anger or animosity or hostility in their hearts. They intend to do bad things to other people. They are deliberately biased. The picture that this new research agenda is painting is quite different. It actually suggests that most bias is actually happening at an unconscious level. It's probably happening among people who are very good and very well-intentioned, people who are trying to do the right thing, and yet without their awareness, their hidden brain is taking them in a direction that they do not intend. there have been a number of tests that have been developed that try and measure these kinds of unconscious biases. I've taken some of these tests, and I find them deeply disturbing on a personal level because they reveal things about me that feel completely alien to me. And I think this is what fascinates me about this work. It really is almost, you know, this is the old joke that the only people who study human behavior are the people who have issues of some kind because they're trying to understand themselves.
Right.
And I think that's sort of true about me, which is I'm really fascinated about this unconscious world in my own head, and that's what prompts me to think about it so much.
Something happened in 2004 that you write about in your book. That, you, in fact, you describe it as sort of changing the way you looked at the world. You tell this story that this was when you were with the Washington Post, and you had been assigned to do the story on Ralph Nader. He was campaigning for president at the time. And so along the way, you came across Mahzarin Banaji.
That's right.
She's the psychologist at Harvard, was at Harvard at the time.
She still is.
Still
yes.
There. And you said you went in and started talking to her, and you say in the book, 3 hours later, you came out and the whole world looked different. Explain what looked different. What did you learn in her office that changed the way you started to see things?
So it was an extraordinary meeting, partly because it wasn't scheduled ahead of time. I was covering the Nader campaign in 2004 because there was so much interest in the Nader campaign based on what happened in the 2000 election. But when I went up to New England to cover Nader, even his closest supporters, his campaign manager, told me they weren't planning to vote for him. And so that told me that his campaign was probably not going very far.
Yeah.
And so I took time off from the campaign when I got to Boston, and I went to Harvard, and I visited with Mahzarin Banaji. She's a very busy person, but she somehow had a free afternoon, miraculously. And so we just sat down and chatted, and she told me about this test that she and her colleague Anthony Greenwald at the University of Washington developed. And it was a remarkably simple test because all it asked you to do was sort of to pair groups of words or associations with different things together. And the fundamental idea is that over time, from the time you're born, you observe the world and you make associations with the things that you see. So if I say the word thunder to you, the associated word that often comes with thunder is lightning, right? Because thunder and lightning go together. If I say salt to you, the word that comes to mind is pepper, because salt and pepper go together. So Anthony Greenwald and Mahzarin Banaji asked, can you apply the same idea of associative thinking to the way we think about people, the way we think about other groups? Are there associations that we carry at an unconscious level about people from our groups and other groups that actually are very powerful and are largely operating at an unconscious level? And they devised this test that eventually came to be called the implicit association test. It's now been taken by millions of people in the United States and around the world. But basically all it does is it basically tracks the speed of your associations with different concepts. And what it reveals is that significant numbers of us have these unconscious associations, for example, where we associate black faces with negative words and associations and white faces with positive words and associations, or we associate men with professional careers and women with domesticity and home life, or we associate gay and lesbian people with things that are ugly or disgusting and people who are straight with things that are beautiful and wonderful. And what's fascinating about this is that these biases are held not just by large numbers of people across the population, but they're held by large numbers of people belonging to the groups themselves that are the victims of discrimination. So large numbers of women themselves will hold the same bias as men do. And I think what this meeting with Mahzarin Banaji sort of taught me was that the model that we've had of how we think about prejudice, that there's a group of victims and there's a group of perpetrators, at the level of conscious bias, that might be absolutely correct. But at the level of unconscious bias, it's actually not a very good way to describe the world, because at some level, at different points, we're all going to be victims, we're all going to be perpetrators, and sometimes we are both at the very same time.
So, and we can dig into this a little bit more as we go, but is the explanation for it, not to oversimplify it, something embedded in our brain genetically or biologically from our evolutionary past? That's the way of unlocking why it is we may have these racist biases deep inside ourselves?
Well, I think it's quite clear that the architecture, the hardware for these biases, is probably built into the biology of the brain. But the nature of these biases, the shape and direction of these biases, is not genetically determined. It's determined really by culture. So I'll give you a very simple example. One of the tests on the implicit association test measures your beliefs or associations with anti-Semitism. And it's actually one of the few tests on which I show no biases whatsoever.
Wow.
And there's an innocuous explanation, which is I grew up in India, and in India, you know, both Christians and Jews are very, very small minorities. And to me, growing up in India, Christians and Jews were essentially indistinguishable, that they were basically the same group. They, right. you know, have the same prophets. They have the same holy books. I mean, the idea
point
that,
is they were different.
But the point is, I don't think about Jews as necessarily being different from Christians.
Yeah.
And so the whole idea of anti-Semitism, which is really between Christianity and Judaism, was sort of alien to me.
Right.
I didn't grow up with people sort of saying, here are the associations that you need to have with people who are Jewish. And so I had to learn those at a very conscious level. And you learn about the Holocaust and you sort of say, my God, millions of people died because people hold these biases. But growing up as a child in India, it was alien to me. And so the idea really is that over time, from the time we're very young, we look at the world and we see the world and we draw inferences about what we see. So, for example, we see when you grow up that most people in positions of power and authority happen to be men, right? Yeah. And so our hidden brain, which is a master at drawing these unconscious associations, logically draws the conclusion that there's something about being men that is tied up with the practice of leadership or the practice of authority. And so over time, we come to associate leadership with masculinity. Mm-hmm. And so when we have a woman now who is a leader, it creates problems for our minds because at an unconscious level, we don't associate women with leadership. Now, what's fascinating about this is that this is not operating at a conscious level.
Yeah.
So you go up to people and you say, do you believe that a woman can be a manager or a CEO of a company? And people will say, absolutely.
Right.
And yet, at an unconscious level, their hidden brain has learned something else.
So help me understand why that would be for – why is it that – let's say someone born and raised in an urban environment of the United States, why would they associate the photo of a black man – with negative terms? What is it? Is that about the cultural impressions they're receiving early on that they're criminals or whatever? Is that what's happening?
Yes. I mean, so you're watching television, you're reading books, you're looking at movies, and, you know, you're picking up what it is that the world shows you. You know, maybe if you're a 5-year-old white child and you're driving with your family and your family drives to an urban neighborhood or a black neighborhood and you see your mother reach over and press the lock on her car as she's driving through this neighborhood, your mind draws the association, look, there's something about this environment that's unsafe for me. That's something about this environment that I need to be wary about. Now, none of this needs to happen at a conscious level. I think what we often underestimate is how much information we're absorbing from the time we are born. I mean, we're just these enormous information processing machines in the brain, and we're taking in these terabytes of information. And over time, we are drawing inferences that at one level are logical, but at another level are completely wrong.
Yeah.
And I think this is the tension between what the conscious brain believes and what the hidden brain believes that really has been the subject of so much of my work.
So there's a difference between the conscious brain and the unconscious brain in this sense. One is deliberate. One is fast. And you write about this in your book that it has to do with the two kinds of experiences we have. One is novel, one is a new experience,
right.
And one is a familiar experience.
Right.
And this is how the brain now starts to segregate the work of the unconscious brain and the conscious brain?
That's right. So, I mean, so what the hidden brain really is doing in much of our lives is it's a time-saving tool that helps us automate many things that we have done many times in the past. So when I wake up in the morning now, I don't actually have to think about reaching for a toothbrush, and I don't have to think about how I'm holding the toothbrush as I put the toothpaste on the toothbrush. I don't have to think about how I'm holding the toothbrush in my hand as I brush my teeth, because I've done those things thousands of times, and they have now become automatic. Now, the first time someone handed me a toothbrush and I had to brush my teeth for the first time, That had to be done with my conscious brain because I had no idea how to hold a toothbrush. I had no idea how to position it. I had no idea where my teeth were.
Right.
There was lots of things that I had to learn. But if you do it 100 times or 1,000 times, it becomes automatic. And when it becomes automatic, the hidden brain says, I'll take this over. You've done this so many times. It's now a routine thing. You can focus on something else that you want to focus on. I'll just do this automatic thing for you. So much of the time, the hidden brain is playing the salutary role in our lives. We're not thinking, as we walk down the street, how do I position my arms so that I'm in balance as I walk? All of that is done automatically. I mean, there's an enormous amount of mental processing involved in just physical activities. You're sitting here at this table in front of me and your hand is on your chin as we are speaking. Your brain didn't think to do this. It's just an automatic way. And you probably sit and talk to most of your guests, right? Which is that the muscles are basically, your brain is controlling your motor system to position your body in this way, to allow you, the conscious you, to focus on the conversation. So much of the time, the hidden brain plays this very salutary role where it helps us do things quickly and efficiently. The problem is, what happens when we apply these automatic rules, these heuristics, these automatic associations to things involving judgments about other people? So if I bring the same automaticity to sort of my judgments as a judge, as I'm evaluating whether someone should deserve parole or shouldn't get parole, and I'm now letting my automatic hidden brain make those decisions, it might not make the decisions my conscious brain wants to make.
So one of the really interesting questions you ask in the book is essentially, you say that we're learning so much about the unconscious brain that the question is no longer, why do we have a hidden brain? It's why do we have a conscious one? What is the role of conscious thought? Because this is interesting. You say that there are so many aspects of the hidden brain that are permanently sealed off from introspection. I want to get a sense of that. So in other words, can we really ever consciously be aware of some of these things? Or are they permanently, as you say, sealed off?
I think it's some combination of the two. I mean, so if I decide, for example, I'm really going to be consciously mindful of how I brush my teeth, I can retrieve that task from the hidden brain and perform that task completely consciously. Yeah. So there are things that I can retrieve from the hidden brain. But there are other things which are truly sealed off completely from the conscious brain. So let me just turn the tables for a second on you and ask you a question. What's your name?
My name is Doug.
All right. So just think about what just happened in those 2 seconds. I asked you a question. My mouth produced sound waves, which hit your eardrum. Your eardrum vibrated. It produced an electrical signal that was transmitted to your brain. Your brain took that electrical signal, converted that into words, put the words into a sentence, understood what that sentence was, went to another part of the brain that basically said, how do I respond to this sentence? Produced an answer, formed the sentence, your motor cortex made your mouth and lips move, and you gave me the answer. Now, we know that all of those things must have happened for me to have asked you the question and for you to have told me your name was Doug. Yet, for you, it was just the most effortless thing in the world. I asked you your name, you told me your name, and everything that was actually important and essential in you being able to tell me your name is not just, you know, you're not just not aware of it, but even if you try to be aware of it, it's completely hidden from you.
Yeah.
And so this is the idea that I was trying to present in the book, which is that there is this mountain of activity backstage or underwater, whatever the analogy you want to use, that's essential for the conscious brain to be doing what it's doing. I mean, it's clear that in our everyday lives, your brain currently is doing 9,999 things that you're not aware of because you're focused on the conversation. Yeah. We know that it must be doing all those things because if it doesn't, you wouldn't be sitting here talking with me.
Yeah.
And yet, much of those things are completely hidden from us.
There's this debate that's been raging for the past, I don't know, 4 or 5 years about whether humans actually have free will, whether we make decisions independently of these forces that are bearing down on us, you know, biological forces. I mean, Sam Harris is one who says there's no free will. Basically, all of the decisions that we make are predetermined based on this, you know, millions and millions of years of evolution. But then there's this other argument, and it sounds like you talking about how culture comes into play that may argue against this idea that, in fact, we're not bound by biology. Where do you figure we are in all of that?
Well, I think we are actually significantly more driven by unconscious mechanisms and by automatic thought than we believe. So I think most of us believe that 99% of what we do is deliberate and conscious and intentional.
Yeah.
I can say confidently that that's completely wrong. That's just nonsense, right? So the question is the unconscious part of our mind, is it 90% or 95% or 100%? That's what we're arguing about. We're not arguing that the unconscious mind actually does most of what the brain does. That, I think, is settled beyond a shadow of a doubt. The question is there a part of our minds that actually has conscious volition and conscious will? I actually happen to believe that we do.
Yeah.
That in some ways, you know, even if you buy the idea of the brain as sort of, you know, a very sophisticated computer, that with a certain degree of complexity, you have emergent phenomena such as consciousness or free will that allow you to actually make decisions and judgments that allow you to express who you are. At the same time, I think we have to be really modest about the claims we make about free will, because I think the more science learns, the more science shows that in many cases, what we think of as conscious, deliberate judgment is really the working of the hidden brain.
So we don't know yet. It's hard. Yeah. What we're uncovering is that maybe we don't have as much free will as we figured.
Oh, I think that's
clear, right?
I think that's definitely clear. There's no question we have much less free will than we think we do.
But here's the thing, though. Like in the book, you also argue if we apply reason, we can overcome and be at least in some way conscious of these biases,
yes.
And then we can apply them to institutions and our own behavior.
Exactly.
So you still think there is.
Exactly.
Some hope.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of hope. Right? I think in some ways the hope that I really have is that most people actually, certainly in the United States, but I think in much of the world, actually probably believe in the idea that all people are created equal and we should have equality of opportunity and that we should live in a fair world. I think most people actually genuinely, truly, sincerely believe that. So given that that's the case, the problem is not how do you convert people who are bad, evil people into good people? The question is, how do you get good people to act in ways that are consistent with their intentions when in some ways their behavior is not consistent with those intentions? And so the fact that our biases are hidden or unconscious certainly doesn't let us off the hook. So I can't say, look, I am not responsible for the fact that I have these unconscious associations because the culture put those associations in my head, I'm not responsible for them. I think we still are responsible for our actions, how we behave, what we say, how we treat other people. And it's incumbent on us to say, if our minds are pulling us in a direction we do not intend, and we want to be good people, and we think of ourselves as being good people, we have to figure out how to compensate for those biases so we don't harm ourselves and we don't harm other people.
Shankar Vedantam is with us, host of NPR's podcast Hidden Brain. Also, the author of the book, the same name, The Hidden Brain. We need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring the hidden forces that influence pretty much every decision we make every day. NPR's Shankar Vedantam explores these forces, and there's a term that he's coined called the hidden brain. It's sort of his shorthand for this wide range of influences that are constantly manipulating us, but most of them we're not really aware of. He has a book called The Hidden Brain. His podcast is Hidden Brain. He is, of course, social science correspondent for NPR, and he's in Utah. He's joining us today to talk about all of this. There's a story you tell, kind of a disturbing story, of course, in your book about a woman by the name of Toni Gustas who was raped in 1986. It's a really difficult story, and we don't have to get into all of the details about it. Suffice it to say, she was sure that she had selected the person that the police figured had done this crime. She was sure that he was the man. And the fact is he wasn't. Say a little something about this, because I want to talk about, I mean, she was with him for a good amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
she should have been able to get this right. And the fact that she didn't, I think, must say important things about the hidden brain.
Right. So the crime unfolded over some period of time, which allowed her presumably to actually observe him quite closely. It's obviously a traumatic situation, and so our ability to sort of think clearly and to have, you know, accurate recollections is disturbed by the fact that something really traumatic is happening. But in this case, Toni Gustas is struck me as sort of a really interesting person, because she's also, besides being a crime victim, she was also a deeply conscientious and sincere person. And she truly wanted to do the right thing. And she agonized when the police presented her with the person they thought was the suspect about whether he was the right person or not. And she went back and forth in her head. And there was a part of her mind that sort of said, I wasn't sure. And then there was a part of her that said, yes, he is. And she went back and forth. And this struggle that she had was sort of emblematic, I think, of sort of her true sincerity, not in sort of jumping to a conclusion, but trying very hard to sort of reach the right conclusion. And then when she sort of had a moment when she was relaxing, she felt at peace with herself, she was in a church, there was a sense of certainty that came to her that this was indeed the man who had done this terrible thing. And she went to the police and she sort of reported this and with confidence. But as it turned out, as you just noted, she was wrong.
Yeah. So what was it about her being in that place of comfort that solidified a choice that was wrong, but made her feel certain? Because you write about in the book these mood states that have this influence on the hidden brain.
Right. I mean, so when you think about the role that emotions play in our lives, you know, emotions are a very, very powerful guide to helping us understand what's happening to us. So if someone says something rude to us and it makes us upset, or somebody gives us a compliment and it makes us happy, these emotional states are very powerful and quick guides to helping us understand what's happening, who is friend, who is foe, who is nice to us, and so on. But these are very broad brush emotional states. In other words, you can't be simultaneously happy and angry and sad at the same time, right? Mm-hmm. So if you have multiple things going on in your life and one of them makes you deeply contented and relaxed and satisfied, and you're also struggling with another decision at the same time about whether you're trying to identify somebody who's a potential suspect in a crime, it's very difficult in our minds to separate, to say, my emotional comfort is coming from the fact that I happen to be in this church at this moment, and it's not connected with my uncertainty and doubt about whether this person is the right crime suspect. It's hard for our emotions are sort of broad brush kinds of things that give us a general sense of how we feel. They're not very good at allowing us to sort of say, here are eight events, and I think about these eight events completely differently, and I need to actually parse each one of them and think of each one of them separately. Most of the time what we do is we sit back and sort of say, how am I feeling in general? And we sort of attribute that feeling then to everything that's going on in our lives.
How far away do you figure we are for the criminal justice system to start applying some of these ideas to the way crimes are investigated? 'Cause it seems like they're not applying it really at all right now. This idea of doubt and the impermeability of memory, for example, all those kinds of things, it doesn't seem like that's really taken into account when you're a prosecutor trying to get a conviction.
So that's right. I mean, one challenge that we have is that our system itself is a confrontational system. We have a confrontational system where the defense attorney is trying to do one thing, the prosecutor is trying to do another thing, and there's a natural competition, tension. Hostility might be too strong a word, but it's set up as a confrontational system where each side is basically incentivized to do the best they can to win. And the idea is that if each side does their best to win, in the end, the system is going to come out well and we will get the right outcomes. You know, possibly much of the time that does work as intended, but the problem is I think there are many assumptions that both defense attorneys and prosecutors and judges and the whole criminal justice system makes that are at odds with the way I think social science research in the last 10 or 15 years has understood how we think about the world. So just the idea of eyewitness testimony itself, if you look at the research literature, you know, closely on sort of the accuracy of eyewitness testimony, you would come away deeply uncomfortable with the idea that it's something that you should rely on hugely. And yet, You know, what is the first thing that the police do when they're investigating a crime? They sort of come to you and sort of say, what happened? I mean, there was, you know, I was in Washington the other day, and right in front of me there was a car crash. One car sort of T-boned into the other, and I was turning, so I sort of witnessed what happened, and I turned, and I pulled over about 100 feet down the road when it was safe to pull to the side, and I called 911, and I reported the crash. And the first thing the person said is, what are the colors of the cars? What kind of cars were they? I had absolutely no idea. I knew there was a crash, and I knew that one car had hit the other car on the side. But instantly, I was sort of saying, well, purple, blue, red. And in my mind, I started seeing purple and blue and red cars. And what I was really doing was I was reinventing and filling in everything that I actually didn't remember, yeah. Right? And this is what we ask people to do in situations when they themselves have been victims of these traumatic things. I mean, your brain is really not attending to detail, to focusing on, you know, what color shirt someone is wearing and what kind of nose do they have and what is their bone structure of their face when something traumatic is happening to you. And yet we sort of rely on eyewitness testimony as if it's sacrosanct. Now, I'm not saying it's not important. Yeah. I think certainly to sort of think about these as sort of certainly valuable in sort of a criminal investigation, but to think about them again with humility, to sort of say, what are all the ways that this could go wrong? What are all the ways I should be skeptical about my own conclusions? I think that's something that I think it's not accurate to say the criminal justice system is not paying attention to this or is not doing something about this. I think there are many people across the system who are aware of many of these findings and are thinking about ways to apply them. But it's a large system. You know, it's turning an aircraft carrier takes time. And I think that's what we see going on right now.
I want to ask, there's a section, and you've talked about this before, you've also written about it, about politics and race. It's interesting. You mentioned Anthony Greenwald and the test that he came up with, Mazarin Menaji. And what's so interesting about this part as it applies to politics in the book, you write about these certain associations. For example, this was interesting. Americans, you write, are quicker to associate Tony Blair, former Prime Minister of Great Britain, in case you don't know, with being more American than Barack Obama. And you say, you ask in the book, if people knew at a conscious level that Barack Obama was American and Blair was foreign, why did their unconscious minds have these opposite associations? So would you talk a little bit about that correlation between race and politics and what's going on in the hidden brain there?
Sure. I mean, and in some ways, I think when you actually think about how the hidden brain works, it's working in an entirely logical manner. So if you look at the, you know, how many presidents have we had? 40-something presidents,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Now, if you look down that list of presidents, every one of them has been white. Every one of the vice presidents has been white. And so it's not an unreasonable association. If you were just presented this, if you were the proverbial anthropologist from Mars and you came down to the United States and you sort of said, here are all the presidents of the United States and here are all the vice presidents of the United States and there are 80 people lined up in front of you and all of them are white, it's not unreasonable to draw the association that you have to be white to be president, or right, you have to be white to be an American president. That's not an unreasonable conclusion to draw. It happens to be wrong,
right,
but it's not an unreasonable conclusion to draw. So the hidden brain is sort of this relentlessly logical correlation machine. And what it does is it basically sort of says, for a long time, whites have been, and they still are, a significant majority in the United States. And so there's something about whiteness and Americanness that's correlated in our heads, in our unconscious minds. Now, if you ask me at a conscious level, can somebody who is African-American be an American? I would say, well, obviously. Can somebody who's African-American be president? Obviously. Can somebody who's a woman be president? Obviously. But that's what my conscious mind believes. My unconscious mind, which has learned from tens of thousands of associations that I've seen from the time that I was 2 years old, might not necessarily agree with what my conscious mind believes. And so that's where the tension arises, which is what happens when your conscious mind believes truly and fervently and sincerely that all people are created equal, but your hidden brain does not.
Is there something in your research about the hidden brain that may explain in some way the rise of Donald Trump as the nominee for the Republican Party? I mean, he's brash. He's not particularly conservative. He's been married more than once. And a lot of those things could have been, in the past anyway, deal breakers for Republican candidates. Anything in your research that explains Trump's appeal?
You know, I hesitate to actually sort of think about applying this research to actually individual situations, because I think what happens is that you're likely to sort of see what you want to see and draw conclusions that you want to draw. And I think we need to be humble about what it is the research can tell us. The research can give us very accurate and powerful views of what happens in aggregate, right? That we have an unconscious association between whiteness and the American presidency. I think that is true, and that is demonstrated. You can demonstrate that with empirical research. When it narrows down to an individual candidate, it becomes, I think, much harder to sort of say this is happening because this particular aspect of unconscious bias is acting in your head. One thing that I think is true and is fascinating is sort of the role that partisanship plays in our lives. And one of the things that's fascinating on both the Democratic side and the Republican side in the presidential election is that there are significant parts of the Republican Party at a rational level that you would say should be opposed to Donald Trump because he has espoused views that have not been particularly conservative over the years. He is on a personal level, on a political level, on an ideological level, he has in many ways demonstrated views that are not particularly conservative. The same can be true, said, for Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side, that, you know, that she has associations with big banks and big business. And, you know, certainly many supporters of Bernie Sanders would sort of say Clinton is a poor progressive in terms of what we want as a nominee for the party.
Yeah.
What's fascinating is that once people become the nominees for their party, how quickly even people who have ideological differences with them coalesce behind the candidate. And I find this just so fascinating because, you know, I think upwards of 80 or 90% of Republicans, including many who said they would never support Trump, you know, have gotten behind the Trump campaign once he became the candidate. Lots of people who said they would never support Hillary have gotten behind Hillary once she's the Democratic candidate. Yeah. There's an interesting theory in political science that has tried to marry together some of the work on human behavior with how we think about politics that argues that we actually have come to think about our political parties the way that we think about sports teams. That at some level, you know, when I have a new quarterback for my pro football team, this person is a stranger to me. I haven't heard this person before. But very quickly, 3 months after I get to know this person, because this person is wearing the uniform of my pro football team, I become a fan of this person. And so my loyalty really, as Jerry Seinfeld once said, is to laundry, right?
That I
have deep loyalty to sort of the people who are wearing my team colors. And I think we sort of see that in the last couple of months in what's happened on both the Democratic and Republican side, which is it's even though people say that they're motivated by ideas and by ideology and by people's views on policies, I think it's actually much clearer to make the case that people are motivated by loyalty to team, and that if it's my team, then I'm going to get behind the candidate, and if it's not my team, I'm going to oppose the candidate.
Shankar Vedantam is with us. His book is The Hidden Brain: How Our Unconscious Minds Elect Presidents, Control Markets, Wage Wars, and Save Our Lives. He, of course, is also the host of the NPR podcast Hidden Brain. You should check it out, by the way. We need to take another break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with Shankar Vedantam, NPR's social science correspondent, host of the podcast Hidden Brain. He also is the author of the book of the same name, The Hidden Brain. I want to ask about, it's not the latest because one just dropped, you mentioned today, but in the podcast, the last one before it was about, it wasn't about the Olympics necessarily, although that's part of it. But you interviewed David Masumoto of San Francisco State. He's an Olympic judo coach and a psychologist, and he studies nonverbal behavior. And he does this study of athletes. This was the Olympics in Athens, I think it was, photographing them at that one moment when they won or that one moment when they lost. Would you talk a little bit about that? Because just for a fraction, culture will kick in a moment here, but just for a fraction, there is this universal way we all react when we win or when we lose, I guess, too.
That's what Matsumoto found. So he had these very high-quality cameras trained on athletes. And even though most of us, when we are watching a sport, you know, we're watching the sport as a whole. We're watching, you know, the outcome of the table tennis match or the outcome of the beach volleyball match, but we're not actually looking, zooming in on the individual athletes moment to moment. And but that's what he did. He was zooming in on the athletes and taking, I don't know, 8 pictures every 2 seconds or something. So he's able to get them in high definition at the instant at which they recognize that they have won. And what he found was that athletes all over the world sort of demonstrate the same sort of facial features at the moment at which they won. It's sort of it's not necessarily all about happiness. It might actually be more about dominance than about happiness. And they're sort of demonstrating that at the moment they won. Again, not surprising. But what he also finds very interestingly is that a second later and a few minutes later, once the athletes are on the victory podium, the cultural messages that they have been taught from a very young age about how you're supposed to behave when you win kick in. And so there are some people who are very brash on the podium, and there are some people who are almost embarrassed to be, you know, winners on the podium because their cultures have taught them, here are the different ways in which you respond to victory. And what I find so interesting about this is that, you know, we often argue about whether, you know, things are nature or things are nurture, but human behavior is really both, that it's really at all, at some level, it's some combination of what's biological and what's genetic and what's innate, you know, superimposed with what's cultural and what's learned and what's practiced. And it's both those things working together that produce what we do and who we are.
Because I did have that question about whether or not we are, quote unquote, naturally racist or, quote unquote, naturally tribal or xenophobic. And I guess there may be some biological explanations for some of our behaviors. But you have to take into account all of that stuff together, the cultural part and the biological part. And so we're not necessarily naturally racist, but we have these implications, these inclinations.
I'm not even sure it's accurate to call it racist, because I think when you say racist, I think the early implication really is that this is something conscious and something that's deliberate.
Right.
I think it's accurate to say that many of us have unconscious racial biases. Now, these are not intentional. I'm not sure that makes you a racist, but it makes you potentially vulnerable to behaving in ways that are racist. So there's a distinction there that needs to be made. But I think it's absolutely true. The brain does come programmed with the ability to form tribal associations. Mm-hmm. That probably the architecture for that is in the brain. So, you know, you could drop, you know, you can raise a, take a baby from China and raise that baby in Salt Lake City, and the baby will grow up to be, you know, American and be proud of America and cheer for America during the Olympics. And so, but if you do the reverse would also work exactly the same way. So our tribal affiliations, what form they take, which direction they take, are shaped by what we learn through our cultures.
One of the things you write about in your book is numbers, that we have a problem with numbers, small numbers and large numbers. We'll talk about large numbers in a minute. But you say in the book, we can't tell the difference between something that has a 1 in 1,000 chance of happening and something that has a 1 in 2,000 chance of happening. Talk a little bit about that, the way our mind processes the chances, because you tell the story of, even though you've done stories on wearing a helmet and how important that is, you went on a road trip to India and didn't wear a helmet. On a motorcycle.
Yeah, I know. It's really, I mean, when I think back on that, that's one of the moments of great idiocy in my life, because I almost lost control of the motorbike and I almost crashed and I might have killed myself. And it was just really just when I look back on it, the only thing I can think of was how profoundly dumb could I have been? But this is the thing, which is that it's not just dumb people who do dumb things, but it's smart people who do dumb things as well. And that's in some ways the focus of what this whole book is about. But yeah, so when you think about numbers, I think what's likely happened is that over millennia of evolution, our minds have become adapted to certain kinds of risks and threats, primarily risks and threats that cause large numbers of our ancestors to die. Because over time, if you evolved to be a human in the early human environment, you know, most people died not as a result of car crashes, because there were no roads and no cars and no automobiles. You died because, you know, of starvation or hunger or thirst, or you died because a snake bit you or a lion bit your head off or a alligator came out of the water and caught you. I mean, so we have these deep and innate fears of predators, and we have these deep and innate fears of things that involve, for example, the risk of heights. I mean, so we don't actually have to learn to fear heights. In many ways, some of that might be hardwired into the brain. Many of the threats that we face in the modern world, however, are not tied to these ancient threats any longer. So if you look at the CDC puts out a list of the 10 leading causes of mortality in the United States, and, you know, alligator attacks are not one of the top 10,
right.
are not among the top 10. Neither are snake attacks, and neither are falling from heights or any of the things that our ancestors, you know, died from. What kills us is, you know, heart attacks and strokes and cancer and diabetes. Many of these are tied to lifestyles, unhealthy lifestyles, the food we eat, the kind of exercise we do, whether we smoke or not. Our mental health. These are the things that actually make a difference to our lives. But the thing is, because our minds are not trained to sort of think about those as being the deadly risks, we will sit at a bar with this huge plate of food in front of us and watch the television in front of us, which is telling us about a serial killer who is three states away, and we'll be terrified about the serial killer instead of the French fries on our plate, when in fact the French fries are going to kill us and the serial killer isn't. But this is the dilemma, which is that because our minds are not very good at thinking about risks and thinking about how we think about risk, we're often afraid of the things that we shouldn't be afraid of, and we're not afraid of the things that we should be afraid of.
Okay, on to large numbers. We're not good with dealing with small numbers, but what you say, we're also not so good with large numbers. And you tell this story of this puppy stranded on this large oil tanker. This is back in 2002. This was in the ocean. And it's a touching story in some ways, but it also raises, as you say in the book, some kind of disturbing questions. You had thousands, tens of thousands of people responding to the story of this puppy being stranded on this oil tanker, and people send in money and cards of support and all of this kind of thing. But then on the other hand, you have It was around this time, or it wasn't much long before, like 8 years before the Rwandan genocide, where in relative terms, not very many people were paying attention. So one puppy on a stranded tanker, almost a million or more than a million, I guess, people killed in a mass genocide. What's happening there? Why are we paying attention to one and not the other?
So this might go back to what I was saying a little while earlier, which is that in our early environment, our evolutionary environment, we grew up in very small groups. You know, we might have been in hunter-gatherer tribes with a few hundred people. And so our relationships with other people were really tied to these interpersonal relationships. So I knew when somebody got hurt. I knew when somebody was in pain because I actually physically knew them. I actually was physically in their presence. I think what technology has allowed us to do nowadays is to learn about disasters that are happening thousands or even tens of thousands of miles away that involve people whom we have never met and probably will never meet in our lives on a mass scale.
Yeah.
And our minds really have not been designed to deal with that kind of information and that kind of challenge. So if I asked you, for example, if I told you about an individual and I said, you know, here's an individual child, I give you the child's name, I tell you what the child likes to do, what kind of games she likes to play, I tell you what she looks like, I show you a photograph of the child, I tell you where she goes to school, I tell you about her parents and her siblings, I tell you about her relationship with her friends, I flesh out for you what this child is like. And now I tell you this child's life is in danger or this child has died, for example. How would you feel about this? And now we now bring all of the information that we have learned about that one victim to bear, and we realize what a catastrophe it is that to lose one life, the consequences it has on everyone around that child, the just the emotional magnitude of that loss is just overwhelming. But now if I tell you, imagine there are 10 children like this, or 100 children like this, or 1,000 children like this. And I say, take that emotional reaction you just had and multiply it by 1,000. Our brains don't have the capacity to do that.
Yeah.
We're not wired to basically take that feeling we have for one and multiply it by 1,000 times and feel 1,000 times worse, which is, of course, what led, I believe it was Joseph Stalin, to sort of say, you know, one traffic death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic. Because that's what happens when you have catastrophes happening on a mass scale. What happens is our conscious minds grasp that a million deaths is a million times worse than one death, that we grasp the magnitude of what's happening. But at an emotional level, at a visceral level, which is often the level you need if you want to get people off, you know, their couch to do something, that emotional push is not there when you sort of present the story of the mass disaster. And so this actually might be a way to understand one of the great paradoxes of the 20th century, which is we've had, you know, mass genocide after mass genocide after mass genocide. And after each one, we sort of say never again, never again, never again. And then the next one unfolds and the world sits on its hands and does nothing. And it's not necessarily, again, because people are bad or people are callous, because this is, again, the irony, right? Because I tell you about a puppy on a tanker who's lost, and people who will never see that puppy and have no connection to that puppy will say, I want to try and do something to help that puppy. So human beings have enormous capacities mm-hmm. for empathy and sympathy and trying to help other people. It's just that when you tell people, multiply that by a million, our ability to sort of empathize breaks down because we're not calibrated internally to have that kind of leap.
We don't have a lot of time to talk about the work of Paul Slovic at the University of Oregon, but you write about him. And he asked these volunteers to imagine that they were officials in charge of this humanitarian effort and how they would allocate the money. And one of the things that he found, this was so striking to me, that people, and maybe you can sort of take me through this in the minute or so we have left, people would rather save 10,000 lives than 20,000 lives.
Well, so Slovic constructs many of these experiments that tries to, brilliant psychologist, by the way, he tries to construct these experiments that tease apart how our minds think about these moral dilemmas. And in one of the experiments he designed, he asked people to imagine two scenarios. He sort of said, imagine there's you're the head of a foundation. You have, let's say, $10 million to spend. You can use it to either, here's condition A, you know, save 10,000 lives from a disease that claims 20,000 lives a year. That's option one. Or B, you can use it to save 20,000 lives from a disease that claims 290,000 lives a year. And at a rational level, when you present those two things, you should say, if my same $10 million can save 20,000 lives instead of 10,000 lives, I should choose to save the larger number of people because that's the right thing to do. But what happens is when we think about this intuitively and when you present the problem in a way that asks people to use their intuitions to solve the problem or to address the problem, what people sort of say intuitively, and when I think about this myself right now as I'm thinking about it, saving 10,000 lives out of 20,000 lives feels like I've saved half the people who are at risk of dying. Saving 20,000 lives out of 290,000 lives feel I've saved less than 10% of the lives that could be saved. And saving 50% feels better than saving 10%, and I gravitate to that. Now, what's interesting about all of these biases that we're talking about is that they're so innocuous. You know, they're not being driven by people who are bad people trying to do bad things. They're being driven by perfectly good people with good intentions, sincere people who are trying to do the right thing, whose unconscious minds are leading them astray.
Shankar Vedantam is NPR's social science correspondent, host of the podcast Hidden Brain, a new one just launched. So you should check it out, of course. And his book is also called The Hidden Brain. Joined us here in the studio. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, Doug. It's been a pleasure.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.